Atrial fibrillation, or AFib as it's commonly known, can increase your chances of stroke, maybe heart failure, other heart conditions. And we'll talk about what causes it and how it can be treated with our next guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Our guest, Dr. Miguel Leal, with us. He's the director of the UW Health's Electrophysiology and Arrhythmia Service. And so we'll take a look with him at the latest research on AFib and certainly take your questions and your experience as well. Maybe you've been diagnosed with AFib. I have two very close friends who have AFib. One of them did have a mild stroke as a result. So it's on my mind more often than not. Maybe it's on your mind as well. What are you doing to control the condition if you have it? What would you like to know about treatment? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. And Dr. Miguel Leal, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
Well, it is a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Let's just start with the basics. What is atrial fibrillation, or AFib?
When you mentioned that you have a few people that you know with the condition, Larry, I am not surprised, because it is a very common cardiac arrhythmia. So atrial fibrillation is a condition by which the heart loses the synchrony that you normally have between your top and your bottom chambers of your heart. Okay. We're all born with typically four chambers in the heart, unless there is any congenital defect. Two on the top, we call them the atria. And two in the bottom, we call them the ventricles. And the way your heart is designed to beat throughout your lifetime is 3 billion times, give or take a billion. You're supposed to have the top chambers followed by the bottom chambers in a one-to-one relationship. And when somebody goes into atrial fibrillation, the synchrony is lost. And then the top chambers, the atria, they start going really fast. We're talking 300, 400, 500 times per minute. And the bottom chambers, fortunately, don't follow suit, but they do go fast and irregularly in an effort to try and keep up what's going on. So this arrhythmia does cause a lot of trouble to a significant number of patients as a consequence of the loss of the natural synchrony of your heartbeat.
So what happens to the person? I imagine, I know this is an unsettling, when something like this happens to a person, it's very unsettling.
You're absolutely right. It's a disease that can happen to people of all ages, but we do see it more notably in folks older than the age of 60 or 65 years old. But we say that, cautioning that it can happen literally at any age. And as you pointed out, it can be very unsettling. Patients can experience symptoms that go from a little bit of a chest discomfort, a sensation of fluttering, of a skipped heartbeat, or maybe their heart feels like it's speeding up for no reason when they're just sitting on a recliner or watching television. But it can also cause many more complex symptoms than just that. It can lead to, as you pointed out, a stroke, which is one of the most devastating consequences of AFib. It can cause heart failure if it's unrecognized and left untreated or suboptimally treated for too long. And it can lead to other conditions that could result in cardiomyopathy, which is a disease of the heart muscle, when the heart is no longer able to keep up with the needs of the body.
So what brings it on, or what's behind it all?
The most common cause that we agree as clinicians treating patients with this disease is simply the age factor. If you look at the age of the population, the reason why we have so many million people with atrial fibrillation in the United States and the world, and only to mention those we actually know about, not to mention those who are probably unaware that they have the condition. If you look at different papers that focus on this theme, anywhere between 3 and 6 million people in the United States are known to have atrial fibrillation. And you can multiply by another factor of those who may not be aware they have the condition. Because AFib can come and go. It can be what we call paroxysmal, which means it will happen for a few minutes, hours, or days and go away. Or it may be persistent when it comes and simply stays. And other conditions besides age that can predispose somebody to atrial fibrillation include high blood pressure, obesity, diabetes, the familial history of atrial fibrillation at young ages. That is a genetic component for this disease as well. And then there are other specific things that can lead to enlargement of the chambers of the heart, such as leaky heart valves. Sleep apnea, it's another condition that in the most recent past has been very strongly associated with atrial fibrillation, and so on. So when you put all those things together, it's easy to understand why the condition is so common.
Yeah, the two people I know both have a leaky valve.
There you go.
And that's what's created. You know, Brian and Rhinelander's on his way to the doctor right now, I think, about AFib. Brian, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, I was listening to your previous show about psychology, and I'm on my way for an AFib appointment right now, going to Rhineland, Wisconsin. 57 years old. I've had it since I was about 18, 19, the first time it happened. And how I got through the physical for the military, I'll never know, but I did. And it has been persistent. I have proximal atrial fib, which means I go into atrial fib without, you know, it just happens. And I have probably been cardioconverted 20 times in my life. I had a stroke. I've had several blood clots as a result. Been on blood thinners for 30 years. And I was offered a number of years ago, they wanted to do what they called the maze procedure. But it was in its infancy and it was in trials. And I chose not to. I guess I'm just, it's maddening because, I mean, it cost me, you know, work. I've been an executive chef for 30 years. And, I mean, when you go into atrial fib, it's, you know, it's just terrible. It's like 220 beats a minute. You have a hard time, you know, getting around. Yeah, it's just, it's debilitating. And sometimes it'll last as long as, if I just let it go, which I don't anymore, but I have in the past, I mean, it could be 3-4 days before I will convert to a normal sinus rhythm.
So is this a kind of a common type, Dr. Liel?
Larry, Brian's phone call really highlighted several important aspects of AFib diagnosis and management, and he is absolutely on par with his disease condition. I wish sometimes that all of our patients were as well educated about that condition as Brian is. So highlighting some of the things he mentioned, the first thing is that, yes, it can happen at young ages. Typically, I mentioned 60 and 65 is an age cutoff beyond which it takes an exponential growth in its incidence and prevalence. And to give numbers to those words, before the age of 40 or 50, less than 2% of people are known to have atrial fibrillation. So Brian belongs to that small minority. But older than the age of 65 or 70, it can be as high as 10%. That's a lot. That's 1 in 10 people. They either have it permanently or persistently, or have it as Brian does, which is this paroxysmal fashion that comes and goes, and sometimes it can last for a few minutes, a few hours, or it can go on beyond several days. Whenever it goes beyond 1 week, we tend to call it persistent and not just paroxysmal anymore. The cost is significant. You heard somebody who said that he was dealt with in many procedures. The cardioversions that he mentioned are procedures by which we try to literally shock the patient back into regular rhythm. So you give somebody an anesthetic agent so they won't feel the shock, they won't remember any pain, and we try to reset the heart back in rhythm. And sometimes that's good enough and it gets the job done, but sometimes the arrhythmia comes back and then you have to escalate care to other modalities. Nowadays, as Brian alluded to, there are many other modalities that are available to try and promote a more sustainable effect in the treatment. And that include procedures that we can talk about later, such as ablation procedures or the surgical maze procedure that Brian referred to as well. But it is a costly condition. The CDC estimates that about $6 billion every year are devoted to the care of atrial fibrillation. Just that one disease condition, that one modality of cardiac arrhythmia can cost society that much. And approximately 750,000 hospitalizations happen every year because of AFib. So you can imagine how many more fold are the patients that are, like Brian, going to a doctor's office to understand what's the better treatment option for him or her. It's also a disease that has to be very much individualized. We've learned by experience that if you have 10 patients with AFib on a clinic day, not one or two of them will be treated the same way. It's a very humbling thing. When we're teaching residents and fellows, we usually have trainees with us at the university hospital, and they're fascinated by that because you really have to personalize, to individualize care to one's needs. Because some patients can live with AFib, it doesn't seem to affect them much, and all you have to do is protect them from a stroke and from heart failure through medical therapy. But there are those who cannot stand it at all. Those patients for whom one or two episodes of AFib a year is one or two too many. And then you really have to respond to their needs in a different way.
Are there, and Brian, I wish you the best of luck. It sounds like you know what you're dealing with there, and you're doing the best you can to treat your issue. And I thank you very much for calling and talking with us today. Appreciate it very much. So there's this whole business of individualize, how do you even decide how to then individually treat someone?
So this question, Larry, generated a number of clinical studies, and the early 2000s were the years that helped us the most in learning that. So studies that involved thousands of patients taught us in the medical community that if somebody does not feel that AFib, if they don't have palpitations, heart racing, dizzy spells, lightheaded spells, in some extreme cases, passing out spells, which you call syncope, you can actually let them live in AFib, provided that you take care of two major goals, that you do not expose them to a risk of stroke by prescribing them blood thinners when appropriate. Not every patient with AFib requires a blood thinner, but most of them do. And the second one is heart failure. You have to make sure that AFib is not making the heart go too fast. You heard me say in the beginning that the top chambers are going 300, 400, 500 times per minute. The bottom chambers fortunately do not follow along, otherwise this would be incompatible with life. But the bottom chambers, which are the ones that cause your pulse rate, the ventricles, they can go fast as 150, 180, 200 beats per minute, which is something that if left alone will cause heart failure in a matter of hours, days, or weeks. So if you treat those two components, Larry, the stroke risk and the heart failure risk, some people can be left alone in AFib and they'll be okay. But it is the case that for many patients, it's not that simple. You have to go after the disease itself.
And we'll talk some more about going after the disease itself with our guest today, Dr. Miguel Leal, director of the UW Health's Electrophysiology and Arrhythmia Service. Certainly inviting your questions. He'll be with us till 12:30 today. Take a look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back with our guests. Stay with us. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking today with Dr. Miguel Leal, who is director of UW Health's Electrophysiology and Arrhythmia Service. We're talking about AFib or atrial fibrillation. About, I guess, 30 to 40 million people worldwide live with that heart condition. And certainly there are a lot of them living right here in the United States and right here in Wisconsin, to be even more specific. You may have questions about it. He has done a lot of work. Our guest has done a lot of work in this area. Certainly happy and willing to answer your questions about AFib. So I hope you'll join us. Number is 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. We were talking a little bit about procedures, and Cindy emailed to say she had an incident of AFib last year. She's 68. Due to prednisone for infection. She's supposed to stay on baby aspirin daily, but now she's read some new studies that say baby aspirin daily can be dangerous. What's your opinion on it?
Very good question, and very timely too, Larry. We actually are learning more about aspirin every single year that goes by. For atrial fibrillation specifically, most patients who have a high risk factor or high risk for a stroke, they will need something a bit stronger than simply aspirin alone. So the first question that a physician, that a clinician has to ask a patient is how many risk factors does he or she have that might contribute to a high risk of stroke? And among those, I'm going to list a few to you here. They include congestive heart failure, high blood pressure, diabetes, age greater than 65 or even more, 75 years old, previous history of stroke or vascular disease. Any of those elements that I just mentioned gives you one incremental risk factor for developing a stroke. So if you have two, three or more of those, you probably need a lot more than just aspirin. You need a dedicated blood thinner. And for many years, for more than four decades, we only had one option called warfarin or Coumadin. Mm-hmm. In fact, a drug that was developed right here. Exactly right. It's a University of Wisconsin byproduct that has helped people in the whole world for many decades. But in the more recent past, specifically within the last 9 years, four other agents have been launched in the market. And they're very widely known because they're in the television commercial ads all the time. But these other agents came up as alternatives to warfarin. So back to her original question, the use of aspirin is something that is controversial in atrial fibrillation. The modern clinical practice guidelines will say that if somebody has a very low risk of a stroke, so in other words, if they have zero or one of those risk factors, a case could be made to just watch those patients, or perhaps if they have one of those, to give them aspirin. But the evidence behind it is by no means as strong as the evidence behind a true blood thinner. Hmm. And by blood thinners, we mean anticoagulants, either warfarin or one of these novel agents that have come up in the last decade.
There we go. Let's take some calls here. Ruth in Chippewa Falls, it's your turn. Ruth, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I have SVT. I've had it for years, and I had catheter ablation. I now have two valves that have a small leak, and I was wondering, is there any possibility that it could go into the other, you know, to have other problems other than that, because I still have reoccurring, my heart tries to start beating fast, but it can't because of the ablation.
Yeah.
So that's a good point, Ruth. Ablation procedures, they're meant to eliminate the extra pathways that one's heart has that may allow for arrhythmias to not only start but perpetuate themselves. So there are many places within a human heart that can start sometimes to just fire at will for no rhyme or reason and trigger these fast arrhythmias. And sometimes there are extra little pathways, extra electrical wires in the heart that some people can be simply born with. And although one can live through an entire lifetime without having a problem, in some patients they do cause arrhythmias. The arrhythmia that Ruth is referring to, or SVT, is the terminology, supraventricular tachycardia, is an arrhythmia by which there is a very fast heart rate. It's usually coming from the top chambers also, but it is different in atrial fibrillation because it's a little bit less disorganized. It's a little more organized than AFib tends to be, and that's why very few people with SVT need to take blood thinners, because it's a condition that leads to less stagnation of blood in the top chambers in the atria, less chance of forming clots, less chance of developing a stroke if that clot decides to go to the brain on any given day or night. Now, her question is, can one thing be linked to the other? The answer is yes. There are certain forms of SVT that are associated with a higher incidence of atrial fibrillation. A terminology that physicians use sometimes is called Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome. Wolff-Parkinson-White is a condition, is a type of SVT that may or may not be Ruth's type, but it is a condition that has been associated with a higher incidence of atrial fibrillation. The other thing that she mentioned in her comment that is important, she mentioned two leaky valves. Leaky valves are among those things we referred to in the beginning of this program that can predispose someone to AFib as well. So Ruth is certainly somebody who needs to maintain a regular routine of following with her primary care physician, or if she also has one, her cardiologist. It does not necessarily mean that because she had SVT or because she has one or two leaky valves, she will necessarily have AFib. But it does bring one's attention to the risk, and it deserves periodic visits to the physician, to the clinician, to see if AFib is indeed diagnosed or not.
Ruth, thank you so much for calling. Jillian in Milwaukee, we'll turn to you next. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for answering my call. Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, I have AFib. I'm 83 years old. I got it 4 years ago. And they have me on something called amiodarone and Eliquis. And at the time when I was first diagnosed, they suggested an ablation, but I was too old. So I was just wondering, is this amiodarone as deadly as it sounds when you read that little blurb that they give you every time you pick it up?
Excellent question, Jillian. So amiodarone is one of the 7 or 8 antiarrhythmic medications that are FDA approved for management of certain conditions. And atrial fibrillation is one of those conditions that sometimes is really hard to treat and requires that a doctor and a patient try one medication. And if it doesn't work, one goes to the other. And if it doesn't work, one goes to the other. And in the middle of all of those trials, there is always the possibility to undergo a more invasive procedure, such as an ablation procedure, when a catheter is placed through the groin veins usually, and it's advanced into the heart. This is usually done under guidance by x-ray, by a mapping system. So nothing is done blindly without guidance. And then we try to identify within the heart the areas that are more likely to contribute to AFib, and we ablate those areas. We deliver either heat or cold energy. The heat energy or burning is called radio frequency energy, and the cold energy is cryothermal energy. So one or the other, depending on the patient, depending on the anatomy, on what the heart looks like. Now, as Jill said, some patients sometimes are deemed to be potentially at a high risk for that procedure, either because they can't undergo general anesthesia or because they have other diagnoses that might make the procedure a little bit risky. So those patients are better served with medications. Unfortunately, there is not one perfect antiarrhythmic agent, a drug that one can say this is going to be the silver bullet against AFib. And as a consequence, you do have 6, 7, 8 options. The one that Jill mentioned, amiodarone, is a strong antiarrhythmic. It has proven efficacy to try and get patients out of AFib. But like any other antiarrhythmic, does have potential side effects. So she is absolutely correct in paying attention to those. In amiodarone specifically, the side effects that have to be watched for are effects that may affect the thyroid gland, the lungs, the liver, the eyes, and the skin. And every time a doctor says that, a patient looks at him or her and says, this is horrible, this is a poison, I'm not going to take that. So it's one of those things when you really have to take the risk-benefit ratio in consideration, because these risks can be monitored. So it's not like a physician will ever prescribe amiodarone to a patient and say, good luck, and I'll see you in a year or two. There has to be a very constant follow-up routine that involves occasional blood tests to make sure the thyroid is in good shape, that the liver is in good shape, the occasional eye exam, the occasional pulmonary function test when the patient breathes on a tube and measures the strength of the respiratory muscles and the lungs. So all these things have to be in place. And if they are in place, amiodarone can be taken. But if one of those toxicities does happen, and we have quite a few patients for whom that's the case, then we have to think of a different alternative. We have to stop the amiodarone and either try a different medication or more invasive forms of management.
Jillian, thank you so much for calling. And I guess Steve in Milwaukee has something that relates directly to what you've just been talking about. But let's go there. Steve, hi.
Hello.
Yes, and you have a question about the doctor thinks about
ablation.
Yeah, catheter.
Yeah, I'm 74 years old. I'm on amiodarone, carvedilol, diltiazem, Xarelto, baby aspirin, and it sounds like a lot, and it is, but it's working about 90 to 95% of the time. I feel great. Other times, I do feel palpitations, but they're not at all debilitating. Makes me tired. Fatigue.
Okay.
And my electrophysiologist has several times suggested that I consider catheter ablation, but I'm not convinced that I need it because I feel great most of the time.
There we go.
That's a great question, Steve. So catheter ablation for atrial fibrillation was actually developed around 1999. So when you put that in perspective with many other things we do in medicine, it's a relatively young field. So it has been around for approximately 2 decades. And as you can imagine, it has evolved significantly since its original inception. So when catheter ablation began in the early 2000s and it became widespread in the United States and beyond, the procedure wasn't as safe and effective as it is today. So at that time, physicians usually tried 1, 2, 3 medications before they say, okay, let's go ahead and go for catheter ablation. But the procedure has evolved at a remarkably quick pace. It has gotten much safer and certainly much more efficacious too. We normally quote that for a patient who receives an atrial fibrillation ablation procedure, if the procedure goes well and achieves its intent, there is a 75-76% chance that patient will be free of atrial fibrillation after a year. So it's not perfect science. It's not going to cure everyone. But 3/4 of patients will be in better shape after the procedure. The question is, who do you take to the table? Who do you propose the procedure to? Because there are risks. You're delivering burns and freezes into the heart. You want to make sure you're doing it to the right patient. So it goes back to what Steve was mentioning. If somebody is frankly symptomatic, if they're bothered, if their quality of life is compromised despite medical therapy efforts, that's the perfect patient to take to the table because you know that you can help him or her approximately 75% of the time and they'll be happy. Sometimes, even if you don't eliminate the AFib, you decrease the burden. They go from having AFib every week to having AFib every other month, which to a lot of patients is a victory by itself.
Oh, sure.
So it goes back to how much it affects him. So if Steve is happy with his quality of life, if the medical regimen that he's currently taking is doing well and not causing him side effects or toxicities to his organs and systems, one can understand why he would say, I'm going to pass for now. Because the procedure is getting safer and more efficacious, we're offering it to older patients these days. There used to be a time when if somebody older than 80 showed up for an atrial fibrillation ablation, that was a wrong thing to do, and nowadays it's become routine. These procedures are being offered for people in their 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and it's a matter of selecting the right patient for whom the risk-benefit ratio makes sense.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate your call very much. And John in Madison, it's your turn. John, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
I just had a question on the effectiveness of Eliquis versus, say, Xarelto. I take Eliquis twice a day. I had a stroke in 2017. I'm 71. Have no other side effects from the stroke. I do get fatigue from Metroprolol and possibly from Eliquis. But Eliquis does seem to work. It's a little pricey. But I've been also told that Xarelto wasn't too bad, but I have also read a lot of different things about Xarelto and some of the safety factors of it. Just like to get your opinion on that.
Boy, those are two that you see a lot on television. If you ever turn the TV on, the ads for those two are very prevalent.
That is so true, Larry. Actually, I was surprised to learn recently that we're living a time right now where these novel blood thinners, these novel anticoagulant agents, are finally surpassing warfarin and how often they are prescribed to people in the United States, which says a lot because warfarin began over 45 years ago.
Yeah.
And these drugs began since 2009. So in less than a decade, they were able to catch up with the only available option and now surpass it. So that probably explains this huge effort that we see in the marketing campaigns and advertising. And then it brings the responsibility to us as physicians. Are these medications that we can safely endorse? And is there one that is better than the other? So to be a little more specific to John's question, since 2009, there have been four additional drugs. And I'm going to mention both the generic and the brand names because often they're known for one or for the other. So one of them is called Dabigatran or Pradaxa. The next one is called Rivaroxaban or Xarelto. The third one is called Apixaban or Eliquis. And the fourth one, the most recent of the four, is called Edoxaban or Cerveza. These four medications have been launched and approved by the FDA for helping prevent strokes for people with atrial fibrillation, among other conditions. It's not just for the fib alone. Some people have other clotting disorders, but focusing on today's topic, they have been approved and they're validated. After they were all launched into the market, now we begin to have those studies that compare one to the other. If I was given this, if we're having this conversation about 5 years ago, I would say they're all the same. We have no evidence to believe one is better than the other, but we're starting to learn that's not the case. So there are patients for whom Apixaban may be associated with a slightly lesser bleeding risk. There are patients for whom Dabigatran may be associated with a lesser degree of side effects, especially when it comes to bleeding disorders. There are patients for whom Rivaroxaban or Xarelto might be more efficacious to prevent strokes. So it's only becoming more and more complex. And this forces the physicians to learn more about each of these drugs and patients to also be well-informed and to have a very frank conversation with their doctors. The two drugs that John is asking about, comparing Eliquis to Xarelto or Apixaban to Rivaroxaban, are nearly equivalent in their ability to prevent a stroke. So what we tell patients often is let's go by convenience. Some of them are taken once daily, others twice daily. And for some patients, this matters. For others, it doesn't. Let's go by cost. Some of them are unfortunately very prohibitively expensive still, and this is a factor we cannot ignore. That's one of the reasons why I think warfarin will be around for a long time, and I doubt warfarin will ever be replaced for two reasons. One is it's the cheapest of the five,
yeah,
by a significant margin. And also, there are patients for whom these new drugs cannot be used. And I'll give an example, Larry. People who have AFib and mechanical heart valves. So anybody who has had a mechanically replaced heart valve cannot take any of these drugs because they have been associated with increased mortality in those specific patients. So that's why warfarin will always have a place in the treatment of strokes or preventing strokes for people with AFib. But back to his question, those two drugs are efficacious. They are safe. Clinical studies are showing that they're prescribed not only in the clinical trial populations, but also in the real world population, as we call it. And it would be a matter of dissecting deeper into John's medical history and looking for other morbidities, other conditions that he may have that would make a doctor decide for one or the other, always taking into consideration the fact that the cost may play a role as well.
And John, thanks a lot for calling. Amanda emailed to say her husband went into AFib in October of 2016 for no reason, it seemed. It was very, very scary. He was only 31. He's not gone back into AFib, but from time to time he feels his heart racing and starts to panic. He is also now on a CPAP machine and doing a lot better. The time between he went to AFib until 2 months ago, our lives have been chasing medical and sleep problems and that AFib brought on to a very healthy 31-year-old.
It is really disheartening because it's somebody that does not expect to be having cardiac arrhythmias. And as we said, he belongs to that small minority that may have AFib at younger ages than 50 or 60. It's a disease that can affect people who are, paradoxically speaking, very well athletically trained. It's one of those things that we never tell patients to not exercise. Exercising is a great thing that leads to a number of cardiovascular benefits. But for those who are extremely well trained, the super athletes, as we call them, there is a paradoxical increase in AFib. Then that one is a reflex-mediated AFib that has to do with the innervation between the brain and the heart, the so-called vagal reflexes. I'm not sure if that's exactly his case or not. It could also be a familial variety of the disease that can happen to people at younger ages. And you'd be looking for a family history of AFib at younger ages like his to see if genetic testing would be appropriate in his case. It could also be a disease related to other things. We know that excessive alcohol consumption can cause AFib in any age. And it's not uncommon for us to see college students or young adults show up in emergency rooms hours after a big party when they had binge alcohol drinking reported, because alcohol is a direct toxin to the heart and it may absolutely push the heart into AFib regardless of how healthy the heart would be otherwise. So it is a problem and it deserves treatment. You hear somebody here or you read the email of someone whose quality of life is affected by it. So it's not the kind of patient for whom a doctor would say, let's just give you a blood thinner, protect you from a stroke, protect you from heart failure. You have to go to treat the disease at its root cause. And that includes, again, either medications, such as the antiarrhythmics we alluded to before, or ablation procedures, which are now becoming more and more mainstream. They're not quite at a point where we can just prescribe ablation to everybody. Normally, we like to try medications first, except for a few select patients that we think would benefit from ablation, for whom we will propose it initially. But usually the course of action, you try a medication first, you give it a few weeks or months to see if it proves itself efficacious or not, then you switch to more invasive management.
You mentioned alcohol. What about somebody else wondered about caffeine?
I'm glad you brought that up because this is one of the most controversial topics. So caffeine has not been clearly proven to increase atrial fibrillation per se. Now, caffeine in excess, and what's excess? You know, more than two or three caffeinated beverages in the course of a day can cause cardiac arrhythmias, can make the heart stimulated enough that will predispose to arrhythmias. It's just that the larger studies that look at atrial fibrillation alone, they haven't found conclusive responses. So what we tell our patients is if they do have AFib, it probably bodes well, as it does for most things in life, to have moderation in caffeine intake. So they can have one, perhaps two caffeinated beverages, but shouldn't go beyond that. If a patient is really bothered by AFib, we will tell them to be even more conservative than that and maybe have 0 to 1 beverages a day and see if it makes a difference. I care for over 1,000 people with atrial fibrillation as one of their diagnoses, and it's remarkable how caffeine intake has variable effects. So I cannot come here to your show and say caffeine causes AFib or makes it worse, but there are some patients for whom abstaining from caffeine or having moderation will help.
And Apple has just unveiled a new version of Apple Watch, which can now do an EKG, detect atrial fibrillation, and detect when a person's heart rate is too low. Is that a good thing?
It's a new era. It's one of those things that, like it or not, it's here to stay. And we as doctors better be ready for it. So patients will be wearing these so-called wearable devices. They include watches and wristbands and other waistbands, anything that can try and detect the heartbeat. And we hope that these technologies will become more and more reliable because we don't want to see a lot of patients panicking with false alarms and essentially driving their quality of life down, not because of disease, but because of their fear of the disease. So this is the learning stage right now. These devices are coming out. We're very carefully watching them to see who is going to perform well, who will not. And it is, I think, something that will eventually help, if properly used in the right patient, in the right person, to identify the disease early on and then treat it before something devastating or disabling, such as a stroke, were to happen.
Well, this has been fascinating. Dr. Leal, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I really learned a lot, and I hope you'll be with us again. I'll come back.
It was a pleasure to be here, Larry. Thank you very much for the invitation, and I hope you have a great one.
Dr. Miguel Leal is director of UW Health's Electrophysiology and Arrhythmia Service. Sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's usually what happens on this program. But I do thank you for your questions and comments and for listening in today. And let you know that tomorrow we'll talk eye strain, what you can do to prevent and relieve it. That's tomorrow at 11:45 on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, hey, thanks a lot for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.